Dr. Walter Block from Loyola University is joining us on the hotline. And Dr. Block, Walter, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, but if you expect me to sing, you're in trouble.
No, you don't have to sing. You can just educate us, though, with some of, I guess, your insights into what's going on. A lot to talk to you about. Today, the automakers, of course, are making another pitch. The pressure's on for Congress to approve this bailout. What should they do, Dr. Block?
Well, I don't think they should be bailing out anyone. They didn't bail out the horse and buggy industry when the automobile industry decimated or ended pretty much the horse and buggy industry. So this is the way that capitalism functions. If companies can't provide consumers with products at a price low enough to keep them in business, they're swept clean. The body, the economic body, if I could use such a word, is kept healthy by getting rid of dead cells. And dead cells are companies that can't survive in the market competition.
Now, you know, we've had, I guess, government bailing out a lot of dead cells, right? I mean, that's what we've been doing now for the past few weeks. A figure that I saw, and you probably had the exact figure, is it we spend up to $7 trillion? I mean, what is the exact figure that we've been throwing around as far as bailing out the financial sector in the past few months?
Well, I really don't know the exact figure. It keeps changing. All I can say is that it's very big, and it shouldn't be more than one penny. Some people say that it's okay to bail out financial companies, just not automobile companies and things like that that aren't really directly involved in finance. But I don't believe that either. I think that the government shouldn't be in the business of bailing out anyone.
Now, here's what the automakers are saying. I mean, we've got an unemployment rate that came out at 6.7%. It's the highest we've had since 1993. The most jobs were lost since 1974. The automakers are saying that if we don't bail them out and they go under, that's millions of jobs that will be lost, and this unemployment rate will skyrocket. So how do you respond to that?
Well, that's exactly what the horse and buggy industry said. They said that if you don't bail us out, whip makers and bridle makers and horse trainers and horse breakers and blacksmiths and people who capture horses, they'll all go broke. And when, or rather, they'll all lose their jobs. They'll be unemployed. And when they're unemployed, the blacksmith isn't going to be able to buy corn or whatever the blacksmith bought, and then the corn guy is going to be in trouble. So this argument has been heard time and time again, and it's just economic illiteracy. The people who are in the horse and buggy industry got jobs in the automobile industry. The people in Detroit will get jobs somewhere else. That's the way the market works. Look, the Detroit is just the last chapter in the Rust Belt story. What's the Rust Belt story? The Rust Belt stretches from, pretty much Massachusetts to Detroit on the western sector of the Rust Belt. Is because of unionism. Unions are like a tapeworm, an economic tapeworm. They suck up all the sustenance of a company and they spit it out, and there's a dry husk, and that's called the Rust Belt. What happened is that unions demanded and were able to get companies through force, through law, through threats, to pay wages higher than productivity levels. Well, when you pay wages higher than productivity levels, profits are negative. And so you've got Rust Belt companies all over the Northeast with empty warehouses, empty factories, empty iron, empty this and that and the other. I used to live in Worcester, Mass. When I taught at the College of the Holy Cross. And there are these big factories, maybe a quarter mile by a quarter mile and six stories high. And, you know, dozens of them all empty because they used to make wire brushes and ball bearings and light metal, things like that.
Right.
And the unions forced them out, and they went down to Alabama and Mississippi and Arkansas and places like that where they're thriving. And the same is true in the automobile industry right now. There are automobile companies that are working in non-union states like Mississippi and Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, for example. And, you know, Toyota and Honda, they're doing just fine. They're not asking for bailouts. This is nonsense. Nonsense on stilts.
Dr. Walter Block joining us of Loyola University. We're taking some calls, 661-2929 on the North Shore, 556-9696 on the South Shore. Let's go to Rob in Mandeville who joins us. Hey, Rob, thanks for joining the program.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing?
Very good.
Dr. Block, it's an honor to talk to you. in the last several months in particular, with the talk of all the bailouts and everything, we've had economists and analysts come on the air and in the media tell us constantly that consumption is the main driver of our economy, or that credit is the engine of economic growth. Could you briefly give the Austrian economics response to this nonsense?
Yes, well, I agree it's nonsense. It's just not, it's not even common sense to say that the consumer drives the economy. Suppose that you're a Swiss Family Robinson or Robinson Crusoe marooned on some island, and you say, hot diggity dog, we got a lot of consumption, we're ready to eat. Problem is, nobody produced anything, nothing to eat. Obviously, you have to produce before you can consume. So the consumer is the tail, the dog of the economy is production. Credit is important. I wouldn't put credit down, but credit has been screwed up by the government. The money stock is the lifeblood of the economy, and the government has just messed up the monetary sector. With the creation of the Fed in 1913 and going off the gold standard. If you look at the 100 years before and after, or roughly the 100 years before and after 1913, we're not quite there yet, so maybe 95 years, you can see gigantic horrible swings and depressions and recessions and panics after 1913, whereas before 1913, under the gold standard, you know, you had a little this and a little that. That's because we didn't have a pure gold standard.
Should we go back?
What the government has done is destabilized the economy.
So we should go back to the gold standard?
Absolutely. A gold standard is sort of like handcuffs on the government, and the government is sort of like a drunken sailor on shore leave. You know, they're spending like crazy. And
right.
Absolutely. The gold standard was a limit on how much money the government can create, and money is the lifeblood of the economy. It's the way we communicate with each other. So what they did is they ruined market signals, and then, of course, the market is less able to perform.
Are there any worldwide currencies that are on a gold standard?
No, not now.
And why is that?
Well, because the politicians don't like gold. Gold is a pain in the neck. Look, there are only three ways the government can get money. One is by taxes, and there are limits to taxes, and everyone knows who's taxing, and if the government taxes too much, we get into North Korean territory where they're starving. Second way is by borrowing. But again, everyone knows who's doing the borrowing, and the government crowds out private borrowing, and, you know, who's going to lend to the government when the government is in danger of reneging on its obligations? The third way is the counterfeit. Look, if you had a printing press in your basement and it could come out with $50 bills that no one could tell the difference between or that somehow were legal, what would you do? You'd be getting elbow cramps turning that crank to print out 50s. Well, the government's no different than you. They want money to spend and buy boats and, you know, get Swiss bank accounts for themselves and all. So they print money. The beauty of this is that they blame other people for price rises that are subsequent. They start saying, well, it's greedy capitalists or greedy unions. Now, look, no, I'm second to no one in my condemnation of unions, but they're not responsible for inflation or for price increases.
Are the unions responsible for some of the problems the automakers have been facing?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Unions are very much responsible for the Detroit auto problems, not for the auto problems in Mississippi and Alabama and
right.
South Carolina and places like that, because there are no unions there, or unions are very powerless compared to the ones.
All right. Now, Dr. Black, do we have a handle? We're going to take some calls in a second. 661-2929 on the North Shore, 556-9696 on the South Shore. Do we have a handle now of what our federal debt is? I mean, at last I heard it was $11 trillion and going up by the second.
Yes, I think that those are the right numbers. They're talking about capping it at $13 trillion. Look, these people are unconscionable and irresponsible. They're spending more. Look, suppose you had a debt like that, you personally, Jeff, and you know you had, say, a salary of, I don't know, $100,000, I'm just picking a number, and you had a debt of $500,000. You'd been living beyond your means. You've been living high off the hog, much
right.
more than your income would justify. That's no way to run a household economy, and that's no way to run a nation's economy. And that's what George Bush and I'm sure President-elect Barack Obama will be no different, and Ronald Reagan, who talked a good limited government but didn't act that way. They've all been irresponsible.
And one more question before we open the phone lines. A lot of people say, you know, well, we've got a real fear of inflation. Others say, hey, we could be heading toward deflation, and they point to oil tanking, and some people say oil can now go down to $25 a barrel. What is the greater threat that we face?
Well, I think the greater threat that we face is the Fed, which will destabilize markets up and down without rhyme or reason. Oil prices falling, you know, people used to complain about $4 a gallon gas, and now what is it, $1.70 or something?
$1.50 I saw in one spot coming in today.
When computers first came out, they were very expensive. They were as big as a whole house, and they cost tens of thousands of dollars, and they could hardly do anything. When TVs first came out, they were black and white, and they didn't operate too well, and they were very expensive. When automobiles first came out, they were the playthings of the rich. A Stutz Bearcat or, Rolls-Royce, only the very rich could have that.
Mm-hmm.
In all these cases, oil now and cars and TV sets have been falling, and lower prices is a very salutary thing for the consumer. People are saying, well, we've got to get the help of the consumer. Well, the consumer is going to buy more gas at $1.50 than he was buying at $4.
And certainly a lot of more people will be hitting the road, right, do whatever kind of shopping or whatever they need to be doing because they can afford it. Let's go to Richie and Metairie. Richie, you're on with Dr. Block.
Good morning, everyone. First of all, Jeff, thanks for the tickets for last night.
Yes, sir. My pleasure.
And Professor.
Yes.
Would you reiterate on the warning from Thomas Jefferson of a centralized bank is more dangerous than a standing army, Andrew Jackson's routing out the money changers from the centralized bank then, and explain the communist Marxist manifesto connection to the second plank or the heavy progressive income tax, which is the second plank of the communist manifesto, and the fifth plank, which is a centralized credit in the hands of the state by means of a centralized bank. Would you go on about the Marxist origins of those?
Well, all in 30 seconds, eh?
Yes.
That's a tough road to hoe. Let me just say that I agree with what you've been saying, and I forget which communist leader, whether it was a dictator, whether it was Stalin or whoever it was, I think it was Lenin, he said that the surest way to ruin a capitalist economy is to debauch its currency. And I'm sure that'll fit in right with what you've been saying. And I think that our man Lenin, I think it was Lenin, not Stalin, was absolutely right. As I've been saying, money is the lifeblood of the economy, and you mess with that, and it's like messing with the blood system. The body gets very sick. Yes, I think that there are Marxist antecedents to all this. I think that our founding fathers were very right in warning us against centralized banking, and we've ignored them, and we've had politicians with printing presses that can print out millions, or in the modern day, checkbook deposits. So I agree with this caller's tenor. I don't know every last plank that he mentioned, but I certainly agree with what he was saying.
All right. Thank you, Richie, for your call. We'll come back with more of our special guest, Dr. Walter Block, Loyola University. Jeff Cruer here. It's Ringside on WGSO. We'll be right back. Joining us from Loyola University, Dr. Walter Block. We've been talking about a lot of these economic issues we've been dealing with. Doctor, you were also the subject of a James Gill column recently that created sort of a firestorm. And I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that concerning the glass ceiling that that women face in the workplace. And also one of the questioners at a speech that you gave in Baltimore brought up the problem blacks have getting paid a lot less than whites. And you gave an explanation that some said that was pretty controversial. I was wondering if you could summarize that and explain what all the controversy is about.
Yes, well, you mentioned two of the three things. Actually, the third one was the one I spoke about most in Baltimore. That is, why is it that there's a pay gap between men and women of some 30%? So I really mentioned only two things at that speech, the pay gap between men and women and also the glass ceiling for women. And during the question period, someone asked me, well, what about the black-white differential in wages? Let's just take the two pay gaps between men and women and between white people and black people first.
Okay.
And there are two theories, and this is what I said at the speech. There are two theories that try to explain it. One is white racism in the case of whites and blacks, and the other is sexism or discrimination against women in the case of male-female income differentials or the pay gap. And I said that there are problems with that theory. The problem with that theory is, look, let's take women. Suppose women and men were equally productive in the market, and let's suppose that you had a man and a woman in front of you and you were going to hire one of them for your radio station, and they each were productive in the market to the extent of $10 an hour, which meant that your revenues would rise by $10 per hour if you had them on your staff compared to the case where you didn't. And they're equally productive in the sense that they're equally able to raise your revenues by $10 an hour. And let's suppose that there's a pay gap of 30% such that the male is going to get $10 an hour, which means you'll make zero profit, and in equilibrium, that's the usual assumption. But because of discrimination, the woman only gets, or the black person, only gets paid $7 an hour. Now, if you were to hire the white person or the male, you would make no profit. If you were to hire the black person or the female, you'd make $3 an hour off of that person that you could put in the bank. Wouldn't this be very tempting? Wouldn't most employers want to do that? And if they didn't want to do it, if they were dyed in the wool racists and sexists, of which I don't deny there are some, wouldn't they be put out of business by people
right.
who aren't racist or sexist and say, hey, look, I'm only discriminating in favor of green, as in greenback.
right.
I'm going to hire the woman or the black person uh-huh. and exploit them, pay them only $7 an hour, and I'm going to make $3 an hour extra, and I'm going to underprice you, my competitors, and drive you sexist, racist out of business. Well, it seems to me that this story is a story told in economics classes, and it's a very powerful story, and it undermines the thesis that it's racism or sexism that accounts for these wage gaps. Doesn't seem very controversial to me, but, you know, people are very hysterical about things like this. You even mention that there's a gap between men and women or between whites and blacks, and people say, well, you're a racist or a sexist for even mentioning that. Well, that's a little hard if you.
Well, look at all the trouble that Lawrence Summers got in.
He was the president of Harvard University, and he, he didn't speak about the wage gap. He spoke about the glass ceiling.
Right.
And he wondered out loud as to why there's a glass ceiling. What's a glass ceiling? A glass ceiling is that women can only rise. This has nothing to do with black people, just females. Why is it that there are so few women who are, whatever, presidents of countries or Nobel Prize winners or, I don't know, CEOs or things like that? And he speculated there's a whole bunch of things, you know, little girls are taught differently, they're socialized differently than boys, the culture, this, that, and the other. And he also speculated that maybe there are biological differences. And then there was this professor of physics or math at MIT, a woman, who said that this speculation on his part made her sick to her stomach.
right.
Well, I tell you, lady, if you're going to get sick to your stomach at the possibility of an idea, maybe you don't really belong in a university.
Yeah.
Or rather, maybe you do, because the universities nowadays are so politically correct.
No kidding. It's amazing.
She belongs in the university being discussed in ideas, and Larry Summers and me perhaps do not, because we're considering... What is it, out of the box or
taking
the envelope
We need to consider out of the box ideas. That's the only way I think we progress. Dr. Block, we'll do it again soon. Thanks so much for joining us.